Buddhist Summer School, Wednesday morning, 6th September 1978. Let us start this morning by imagining we are all philosophers, not talkers, arguing about ideas, not intellectualists, but men of vision, because we are lovers of wisdom. Because we have at least some knowledge of the Dhamma. We have some experience of wisdom in the sense of the divine wisdom, the original theosophy, the theosophia of the Kabbalists as presented in their Tree of Life and so on. The perfection of wisdom in Buddhist terms, prajna paramita, of enlightenment, mahakaruna and mahaprajna. We are philosophers in that sense. Now just imagine that intensely, because all that is within us. And if we want any evidence, the simplest evidence is that we are gathered here together in the name of all this, and we are gathered together with a true intensity of right aspiration, of perfect aspiration. Therefore we are philosophers, not philosophists. Now we'll continue from yesterday. The empirical thought consciousness, the mano-vijnana, which deals with the five sense consciousnesses and integrates them. The mano-vijnana, the discriminating, judging intellect, turns into the intuitive consciousness of inner vision, in which the special and general characteristics of all things can be clearly seen spontaneously, without hindrance, and in which the unfoldment of various spiritual faculties takes place. We may wonder, what are these spiritual faculties spoken of? Those of you who were present last year may recollect that when Gautama, before the enlightenment, goes to his two teachers, one after the other, Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta, they teach him certain things which enable him to enter some of the deep states of jhana, or if you like the Sanskrit word, the dhyanas. Alara takes him to the plane of no thing, which is a very deep state indeed. The plane of no thing. And Uddaka Ramaputta, a step further, as it is put, but actually it is not a step further, it is all a difference in intensity, which is called neither perception nor non-perception. And bear in mind that perception at this level is not what we commonly mean by perception through the senses or through the activity of our abstract intellectual processes. It is something which belongs to a higher octave altogether. Now, when Gotama reaches that which is the same as that which Uddaka Ramaputta had reached, he tells, manifests clearly to Ramaputta that he is also like that. And Uddaka Ramaputta invites him to be a co-leader of their group on equal terms, with equal status with himself. But Gotama reflects that this Dhamma does not conduce to disenchantment, desirelessness, stopping to calm, and then to abhinya, special knowledge, sambodhi and nibbana. There's a lot yet to be realized. Abhinya is this special knowledge and under which the special faculties are grouped together. These special faculties are clairvoyance and clairaudience. The real clairvoyance and clairaudience, not the professional clairvoyance and clairaudience of all those who make their living by that process. The iddhis, the psychic powers, the jatis, the states, the conditioned states of others and one's own, and the certainty of attained emancipation. Now, as you know, this word jati, translated as birth and also as rebirth, essentially means the conditioned state. The moment there is a beginning, an appearance, a coming into manifestation, into concretization, that is the meaning of jati. It is something which is conditioned. The transcendent, the utterly free, the beyond our dimensions become concretized. And therefore that is the way to look at jati essentially. And he can see the jatis of others, the succession of jatis. And this idea of succession is the one that produces this idea of an entity reincarnating, which is a mistaken idea altogether. In one's own lifetime, from the time we are born till the time this organism dies, there is a succession of states in terms of consciousness, psychological conditions and bodily conditions. And these are continuously changing. Gotama's primary interest was the mind and the functioning through that mind of consciousness, of the vijnana, which is the alaya vijnana, if you use Buddhistic terms. If you use Upanishadic terms, you'd say Brahman, you'd say Atma. You see? And it is like the analysis which psychologists carry out, sort of going back and tracing things back to their roots in the past. Now, a person like Gotama, whose psyche is completely purified, whose power of attention is fully developed, can look back through every single transformation, backwards, backwards, backwards. He talks of being able to look back 91 aeons. How far does that take him? People try to present these aeons, kalpas as they are called, in terms of so many years, mortal years. This is nonsense. The word kalpa simply means a period of time. And particularly in Buddhist philosophy, the instant, the kshana, and the instantaneous change which takes place. And each instant is the moment of your lifetime, your span of consciousness, so to say. And he looks back through the infinite, well, it comes to an infinite succession practically. When you just look back even a few years, you can't count these different changes of consciousness. And I think that is a much more sensible and practical way of looking at it, because it keeps one's attention fixed here, and when I say fixed, on the moment as such, the living moment, and it doesn't, it prevents, saves one from sort of imagining an infinite past and anticipating an infinite future with the worst consequence of all, expressed in that lovely Spanish word, mañana. Putting off for tomorrow what should be done now, you see, and therefore you fail to live now. And you become your own jailer thereby. See? So, the ability to look into others' jatis and one's own, and the certainty of attained emancipation. Realized emancipation. A certainty which manifests itself through one's life with that sense of courseness. Of course it is so. That is all. What is there to it? It is so. I, Rod Laver, am the tennis champion. That's all. It's like that. There's nothing to it, so to say. The tennis champion goes on practicing and becoming a better and a better champion. That is all. Now, this consciousness is called the consciousness connected with retrospective knowledge. Pratyavekshana jnana samprayukta chitta varga. That's its full title. Or, it's known as the distinguishing wisdom. The distinguishing wisdom, mind you. Always differentiate clearly wisdom from knowledge. Knowledge which is acquired, which is an intellectual acquisition, whereas wisdom is the immediately functioning capacity to perceive the truth of things and understand everything as it is in the moment. This is very, very important in the religious context. The difference, the distinction between wisdom and knowledge is tremendous. In ordinary philosophical terms, it isn't. Through this wisdom, the functions of samjna skanda, the sannyas, what we commonly call the perceptions, the group of discriminating processes summed up as perceptions, are turned inwards, and they become transformed and intensified into profound insight. Profound insight. Until in their culmination they become pure buddhi, the unerring insight of the one who is no longer liable to delusion, as the Buddha declared of himself. And in which the individual characteristics of all phenomena and their general and universal relationships become apparent. You see the importance of this. Therefore, whatsoever one perceives, whatsoever the enlightened one perceives as a particular phenomenon at the moment or a particular person, is never separated from his understanding and perception of the total relationships between that phenomenon or person and the total environment. You know, this is one of the meanings again of omniscience as ascribed to the perfected holy ones. The embodiment of this distinguishing wisdom of inner vision is Amitabha, the Dhyani Buddha Amitabha, represented in the gesture of meditation, Dhyana Mudra. His emblem is the fully open lotus, the fully blossomed lotus. See, Om deals with the universality of consciousness and with Vairochana. Mani Padme, the Padma, is this of which Amitabha is the Dhyani Buddha representing it. Please do realize again and again, all these ways of talking, they are just ways of talking. They express that which is within the living individual himself. All the Dhyani Buddhas are within us, ourselves. They express those aspects of our mental life and process when they have come to their culmination, and therefore the individual has become the fully, to use a phrase which is common everywhere, the fully self-realized being. You see? They are not outside entities flapping in the air or having their particular office and secretaries and whatnot who carry out their orders. The remaining five classes of sense consciousnesses. Now you see, we have dealt in terms of these Dhyani Buddhas with several types of mental functioning. Now the five classes of sense consciousnesses, the eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, sight, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling, you see, become the tools of the bodhisattva life. Now this is very important. It shows at once that Buddhism is a very practical religion. One doesn't discard the use of the senses. Particularly in the yoga philosophy, the verbal statement is often very inadequate. They talk of pratyahara as the withdrawal of the senses and sense functioning from sense objects. How on earth do you live at all then? It's totally impossible. The yogi is the very reverse of the person who withdraws himself from the sense world as such, you see. He, in fact, enters the sense world far more intensely and purely than the ordinary man in the world. Pratyahara, as I have pointed out again and again, essentially means freedom, or withdrawal if you like, freedom from attachment and aversion consequent upon sense functioning. That's what it means. So, sense consciousnesses become the tools of the bodhisattva life, dedicated to the realization of enlightenment, in which actions and motives are no more egocentric, self-concerned. They are unself-concerned, which means that what is one's own self is on terms of sameness with everybody else also. You see, one is not, one doesn't abstract oneself in the perverted way, the reverse way, by saying, I am not, but you are. That is also an absurdity. You see what selflessness means. And you see what an extraordinary freedom it brings to the individual being when, not by false self-identification with others, but by a real vision that all of us, including oneself, are different versions of each other, different varieties of expression of the one mankind. And therefore, the unity of life is an intelligent and a sensible reality in our own consciousness and being. There is good sense. Millions of people think that they are hard-headed, practical, common-sense people, that they cannot be fooled and all the rest of it. They are just as stupid as anybody in the world, you see. The really sensible person is the perfected Holy One. Sensible, sensitive and sensible. And so, in which actions and motives are no more egocentric but truly selfless. Now, this selflessness is more than what is meant by the word altruistic, a term based on the distinction of self and others. The term altruistic separates the self. I am altruistic. And it is quite different from the idea of Christian charity or of modern social service. In the theistic religions, the self is a separate self. That's why we talk of my immortal soul. Either we all end up in heaven or downstairs, as the case may be, you see, but we are all separate individuals, experiencing perfect felicity in heaven or delightful misery in hell perpetually. You see the absurdity of the situation? This individual entity fellowship in the kingdom of heaven, or if you like in Nirvana or anything, is absurd to the nth degree. Such actions and motives are not, that is to say, of the bodhisattva, the utilization of all his sense faculties and all his sense life, are not karma creating or binding, but liberating for the doer and also for those who are influenced by his actions, those who are naturally influenced. There is no compulsiveness in it. Always bear that in mind. The perfected Holy One, like transcendence itself, exerts no compulsive influence. Apart from the inevitable consequence of being what he is. You see, if the clouds don't come between the sun and us, the sun shines and we get light and warmth and all the rest of it far more intensely than when the light of the sun is cut off somehow or other. See? Well, that light and heat may not be agreeable for some. It may be too much or whatever it may be. But the sun can't help that. It is like that. The functions which are characterized by the group of mental formations the sankskara skanda are thus transformed into the consciousness connected with the knowledge of the accomplishment of that which ought to be done. You see, we have dealt with the sanya skanda, the perceptions group. The Dhyani Buddha is Amitabha there, and as the Bodhisattva lives and functions and proceeds, the samskara skanda is transformed into the consciousness connected with the knowledge of the accomplishment of that which ought to be done. And all that happens here and now in relationship to mortals and this world in terms of the sense life and sense activities all the time. You see? And this is the Krityanushtana Jnana Samprayukta Chitta Varga. You see? The treatise known as the Vijñapti Matra Siddhi Shastra says, this kind of consciousness manifests itself for the benefit of all living beings in the three kinds of transformed actions and accomplishes the deeds that ought to be done according to the vow. Now, this knowledge of the accomplishment of that which ought to be done, that which ought to be done. In the Theravada writings, you find the Buddha saying that when all the asavas, the overflows of consciousness from the pure state in the deepest meditation into kama asana, asava, bhava asava, desire overflow of consciousness, the passion to become this, that or the other asava, you see, they are called usually called cankers, but if you use the original meaning it comes closer to the reality. An asava is an overflow, an exudation. When you stick a knife into a rubber tree, say, there is immediately this outflow, isn't there? Exudation. Well, now this is precisely what happens. When the power of attentiveness is weak for any reason and you get entrapped, you get trapped in some sense impression or sense reaction and so forth, there is an overflow of consciousness in its pure state, out of its pure state, into this limited condition. You see? And that is the kama asava, the greed lust group, canker or overflow, the bhava, I want to become this, I want to become a Buddha. Well, says the universe, you can't become a Buddha, but Buddhahood can manifest through you if you just keep quiet and be sensible, you see, and so forth. So that, and the Buddha says, then he knows, when it is all realized, then he knows, done is what ought to be done. This is the last jati. Don't translate it as the last incarnation, for goodness sake. This is the last conditioned state. No longer will consciousness be caught up in a conditioned state. The awareness of totality, the reality of transcendence, the light of transcendence will shine through that psyche and mind in perfection, with no cloud ever coming between that light and the world. The world being first and foremost one's own psychophysical being. And then the meaning of the vow, done, ought to be done according to the vow. Now in Mahayana, of course, the vow refers to the Bodhisattva vow. The Bodhisattva vow to work not with the object of himself realizing salvation, not merely himself realizing salvation, but helping each and every one simultaneously to realize salvation. And you see, it seems to me there is a slight misunderstanding in this kind of presentation. The Buddha always called himself an arahat. And he used the word bodhisattva referring to himself before enlightenment. He says, whilst I was still the bodhisattva, and then the striving by the banks of the Niranjara, and he becomes the fully self-enlightened one. Samyak Sambodhi was his. You see, the perfect enlightenment. And then he calls himself Arahant am I. That's what he says of himself. Whereas in Mahayana, as it grew up, a distinction was made. The Bodhisattva is somewhat on a higher level, a higher status. And personal salvation, the selfishness of working for personal salvation was attributed to the Arahant. Well now, consider it. In the process of growth towards Arahantship, self has long disappeared before the full realization is there. The Arahant, by virtue of living in the world as such, true, he may live considerably apart, but he comes into the towns, into the villages, into the cities, he teaches, he does his job as completely as anyone else does his job. Therefore, his influence is perpetually one which is involving, which is helping others to awaken. Who is the perfected Holy One? The fully awakened one. The Arahant, by virtue of his presence, has the same sort of effect as the Bodhisattva has. Why the distinction? Why the attribution of something superior or inferior? And what an extraordinary bit of evidence of inadequate perception in trying to compare things in the realm of transcendence, in the realm of the infinite. The consciousness of the Arahant, the consciousness of the Bodhisattva, the Buddha, is in tune with the infinite. And whatsoever is in tune, in real harmony with the infinite, is in the realm of the immeasurable. Where is your yardstick? You must have separateness, broken upness of the primordial unity in order to compare one thing with another. You can't measure and you can't compare. People just never seem to see that. The tremendous contrast between the context of the infinite, the immeasurable, the immortal, with our ordinary context of the finite, the measurable, and the mortal. You see? That is why the theologies of the world fall down so easily when they start spouting about God and the heavens and the angels and this and that and the other. The moment we start making differentiations and trying to build up systems, conceptual systems, we are always in danger of that difficulty. See, we always step it down and spoil it thereby. We take away infinity, we take away immortality from infinity and immortality by writing theses upon them. The vow is the bodhisattva vow. The three kinds of transformed actions are those of body, speech and mind. Our actions of body, speech and mind are particular and limited to our own bodies and to our own little environment. But body in this context is the universal body which includes all beings. Speech is the word of power, of prophetic speech. And I have, I think, spoken often enough of the meaning of prophetic speech to expand upon it, unless you want to talk about it a little later. Mind is now the universal consciousness and the consciousness of enlightenment, not just one's own mental processes born out of the particular state of one's own psyche, which is not wholly empty, wholly transparent to transcendence. They act everywhere. The Buddhist presentation of the 10 directions of space, the 4 cardinal and the 4 intermediate points, north, south, east, west, north, east, south, east, south, west, etc. You see? the nadir and the zenith, they are symbolized by the double vajra. We've talked about the vajra on the first day. The Vishva Vajra, as it is called, the emblem of the Dhyani Buddha Amogha Siddhi, who is the embodiment of the all-accomplishing wisdom, whose gesture of fearlessness is the Abhaya Mudra. Now, just a word about prophetic speech. Speech which is power. When one ordinarily converses, one is limited to our own little human sphere, the sphere of human frailty, the sphere of subhumanity. That ordinary speech deals with all that. And it expresses, ordinary speech expresses our shortcomings, our short-sightedness, our ignorance of this, that and the other and so forth. One of the reasons why the practice of silence is so earnestly enjoined upon the serious religio was just this, that if he learned first to hold his tongue, his brain would still be chattering away, but he could be more awake to the significance, the meaning, the implications of all that chatter. And he would see increasingly clearly how useless all that chatter is, and a good deal of it, perhaps the major portion of it, is actually harmful. It's a frittering away of life energy, and when it consists of gossip and such things, it is malicious. It is an act of hate against others, against oneself too. So, the practice of silence as far as audible speech is concerned starts the ball rolling. And then as the perceptions really deepen, they soften one's heart, then one becomes freer and freer from aversion. Reactions which are harmful, this is very important. Harmful to oneself as well as to others. Harmful to oneself particularly, where the brain merely goes round and round like a squirrel in a cage or a mouse in a trap. You see, spinning out all kinds of intellectual cobwebs about the nature of things, the truth of things. They're all false. They have no warrant in truth whatsoever. So that way one harms oneself by this endless chatter inside the brain. And then where comes the point? Through development and therefore through the tremendous psychical influence which one radiates out of one, a pure influence, an enlightening influence. Through that, the speech which one concerns oneself with is the speech that will help those around who care to listen and care to work upon it, will help them to release right aspiration, perfect aspiration, towards the realization of the purpose of their existence in this world. That is, to be released out of the bonds of the subhuman state in which we all are and grow into our full true humanity. We don't know what it means to be human. And the person who speaks that way and naturally, spontaneously, without his desiring to do so, inspires the other person, that is prophetic speech. And you will find that in all the religions of the world, in some way or other, in some symbolical form or other, this fact is presented. Since we are in Europe and were brought up in the milieu of Christendom and Christian teaching, of which the Bible is the principal scripture as such, you find throughout the Old Testament, for instance, and then the Spirit of the Lord moved so and so, and he spoke thus and thus. Or the angel of the Lord came and spoke thus and thus. So, happy, a convenient, symbolic way of saying what happens, what has happened to you yourself, inside your own being. And because you are sensible and perceive that this is the right circumstance and this is the right time to say just these things, you say them. You see? And that inspires the listener to awaken. This is prophetic speech. It has nothing to do with foretelling the future and so forth, in terms of space-time and temporal events and so forth. You can foresee that also if your constitution is such that you are gifted that way. But that is of not special importance. What is of real importance is the release of transcendence within us, the immanent divinity within us, till it reaches its full culmination in Buddhistic terms as Buddhahood, as the enlightened one, who is also the transcendentally wise one and compassionate one. And the two always go together. They are the aspects which Buddhism emphasizes most of all. This insight, the prajna, the wisdom, coupled with karuna, the compassion.